Good evening and welcome to Around It About Chattanooga. I'm your host, Michael Edward Miller, and tonight we've got something very special. We've got an extended conversation with someone who survived the Jonestown Massacre. Laura Johnston Cole was a member of the People's Temple in 1978 when Jim Jones led more than 900 of his followers to commit suicide. Cole got out alive and spent 20 years recovering and rebuilding her life after the Jonestown Massacre. Today, she's a teacher, a Quaker, and a public speaker. She often gives lectures about her life in the People's Temple and how she made it out alive. She'll be in Chattanooga for a few days in April to give presentations at UTC, the local Quaker meeting, and the public library. She's written a book called Jonestown Survivor, An Insider's Look. When she's at the library on April 16th here in Chattanooga, she's going to have signed copies of her book. And in this segment airing tonight, WUTC's Richard Winham speaks with her in advance of her visit here. This is an extended conversation, one of the most in-depth interviews we've actually ever aired. Again, she'll be here on April 16th at the Chattanooga Public Library. She'll also be here on April 15th at the Chattanooga Society of Friends meeting. Now, here's her extended conversation with WUTC's Richard Winham.
When anybody first hears about Jonestown and all of the events that occurred, I suppose there's this inevitable response of, really? I mean, you didn't see this coming? How could you be so naive? That kind of thing. But I have to tell you, having read everything, well, I haven't read everything, but having read some of what you've written and read a couple of interviews with you, and maybe it's naive on my part, but it seems to me that that your position was fairly rational, that you were drawing on the experience and philosophy that had guided your life up to that point, and that what you were going to be doing there was very much in line with that, and that you had very idealistic and humane motives for what you were trying to do.
Well, I definitely feel that when I moved into People's Temple, it was exactly what I was looking for, because I had a spokesperson who was articulate and had a lot of contracts and could speak to other people who were really my heroes around then, like Angela Davis and Cesar Chavez and some other people. So I had somebody who had a voice and who could bring together this wonderful mixed family, rainbow family of people from not only every color, but every socioeconomic level and every educational level. And we were always, part of one body. We were never disaggregated or segregated. We did everything together. And so, the genius of somebody who knew how to work the field and the genius of somebody who could apply new thinking and some different kinds of fertilizer or whatever it was, everything we did really called on the strength of everybody. And so we felt like we did build the community. It was our group effort. It was not top down in terms of the kind of organization we had.
Yeah, I understand that. I can understand why you would you'd feel very much that you had a sense of common purpose and that you were all pulling together for that. And yet the first time you were exposed to him, if I can use that expression, the first time you didn't exactly meet him, but when you went to one of his services, the first service you went to, you walked away not feeling that was something you really wanted to be a part of.
My life had really fallen apart because once I went to college, I stayed in college 3 years as a philosophy major, and that was less and less making sense to me because, of my experiences outside of school. And then I got married, and I was, blissfully married for 9 months, and then that fell apart. And then I tried working with the Black Panthers, and that fell apart. And then I tried going to Woodstock, and that fell apart. So I had tried all these different things to kind of figure out where I needed to be going, and everything was spiraling down in my life.
Can I stop you for a second, Laura? Can you tell me, how does a young white woman become a member of the Black Panthers?
Well, it was interesting because I worked in I put my way through college working in a local housing project. And so I was teaching arts and crafts and tutoring in a local housing project.
Was this in California?
No, this was in Connecticut, Bridgeport, Connecticut. So I, you know, went to school and studied philosophy, and then my afternoon job was to meet these kids when they got out of school and help them with their schoolwork and other issues. So I, you know, became kind of immersed in Bridgeport, not necessarily politics, but the environment, you know, being involved locally, not just at the college campus. And then when I dropped out of school after I got married, I started working in a housing project where the Black Panthers had a free breakfast. So I, you know, walked right by that on my way to the little multi-service center there in the middle of the housing project. And so I just started going there, and I would help them, you know, with the breakfast as much as I was able. And because I was white, they wouldn't let me ever serve the food, but I could clean the tables and empty trash and do, you know, like a complete role reversal of what the society looked like, especially in the South, but in many places around the country. So I was put in the position of, you know, wiping up after the kids got up and setting out silverware or something, and then people who are part of the Panthers would be the ones who served the food and talked to the kids and got them going and everything. And I didn't really have a problem with that because I just loved that the kids would have role models feeding them. And so it didn't bother me, you know, that there was that difference. But as, you know, we progressed on, and I eventually had four or five Panthers living with me in my apartment. And so it just, you know, it went from being a political involvement to then I was part of their meetings because they'd have them in my kitchen. And then they would, you know, come into my kitchen with their guitar cases and violin cases, which were carrying their guns. And then eventually somebody was shot in my apartment. And then the Panthers took the guy to the hospital, and I was left cleaning up the blood, you know, in my living room and down the hall and down the hall of the apartment complex and stuff. And really about that point, I thought, you know, whatever my dream was, this wasn't it.
Who shot him?
Somebody, another person in the apartment.
One of the other Panthers?
Yeah.
So their reputation is somewhat well-deserved, then?
Well, you know, I mean, I think, I mean, many reputations are well-deserved, and then people get themselves in circumstances that you wouldn't predict. Like, you know, it was the guy that I was dating who shot somebody who was sitting too close to me. So in a way, it wasn't, you know, it had nothing political to do. It was just, you know, an 18-year-old who felt that his masculinity was being challenged, and he happened to have a gun, and so that's, you know, I mean, it wasn't a political issue. It was just a, you know, a very unfortunate and kind of 18-year-old kind of response.
I understand. But the Black Panthers, you know, on the one hand, as you were saying, they had a social agenda and they were trying to realize it, like so many other groups at that point, these kind of ad hoc groups trying to help people who were disadvantaged. On the other hand, the Black Panthers, and that may be that that's stereotyping, and it's the media responding in fear of them as much as anything. But they were always presented as people who had their message and their philosophy was the antithesis of Martin Luther King, who they felt had, by the end of his life, proven that his philosophy of nonviolence wasn't really effective, and that they were going to take an armed response to the same civil rights struggle.
You know, the history of the United States, if you think back about the 1960s, which had such a huge impact on me, the people that I respected most of all were all gunned down. So there was, it's not like we were giving respect to much of anybody back then, because both the Kennedys, who were white, and Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, who were black, and Medgar Evers. I mean, the people who were black were shot down, too. And at that point, you know, I grew up in Maryland, which really did kind of focus its energy on being Southern, even though it was above the, you know, the Mason-Dixon line. People in Maryland really did think of themselves as Southerners. And so I could completely understand that for all these years, blacks had been emasculated within their communities. They had been terrorized by the police that came in or by the Ku Klux Klan or not hired because they were black. So all this history of the way we've abused people of color in this country was just horrific. And so in the 1960s, you know, I said to myself, I don't want bullies running the country anymore. I don't want bullies, you know, killing, assassinating my leaders. I don't want it. And really in the black community, they felt the same way. Like, enough already. We've been emasculated. We've been put down. We haven't been given our rights to vote or anything else without a fight in every venue. And I just think that the response was really pretty easily understood because they had really been misused and abused so much before that. I mean, the fight that we had to fight, this country that's based on freedom, and the fight we've had to fight even today to allow people to vote, it's just horrific. And so we're not living up to our ideals.
And yet at the same time, it must have felt like at that point that you were in, or you were entering anyway, a war zone.
Well, I wasn't in a war zone because,
well, people shooting at each other, you know.
Right. But, I mean, there are people in this country who, you know, I mean, even our vice president shot someone in the face, you know, when Cheney was at a hunting. So, I mean, guns are part of many people's nature. I mean, I'm a pacifist, you know, I'm a Quaker, so I'm not going to carry a gun and I'm not going to support it. But guns are a way of life for not just the, you know, these members of the Black Panthers, but in many sections of our country, guns are as available as wallets or cell phones.
But still, you gave up on the Black Panthers for some reason, right?
Right. I was very naive, and so I wasn't really able to protect myself from getting too involved in it. And so I, you know, did and do support their efforts because I think that, you know, for the children to see them handing them food and stuff, you can't replace that by having, you know, that was just a wonderful time. But I personally couldn't spend any more time and be healthy in that setting. So, yeah.
And so you moved to San Francisco at some point and to live with your sister?
Yes, and my sister invited me out. And the very next Sunday that I came to San Francisco, she told me that her attorney friends had told her about Jim Jones and that he had this wonderful community up in Redwood Valley, which is about 2 hours north of San Francisco.
And that interested you for the same reason that you were drawn to the Black Panthers, because of the social activism?
Well, that, and also, you know, she didn't really know all the details of the social activism, but I knew that. And when I was growing up, I grew up in an all-white community. I went to an all-white elementary school. I went to a middle school that, you know, they were just beginning to integrate, and a high school that they were just beginning to integrate in my county and in my state. And so what I knew already is I did not want to be surrounded by clones of me. I didn't want to be surrounded by an all-white group of people who, you know, were middle class and had so much really handed to us. I didn't want to be surrounded like that. Life was too full to be in like a, you know, kind of a white bread kind of environment. I didn't want it. So it appealed to me because it was mixed, and I wanted to have that as part of my life day to day.
To what end? To try to improve people's lot in life?
Well, you know, just on a very personal level, I was just really selfish. I did not want to have, I didn't see my future as, you know, continuing along the path of being a white person in America with all white friends.
Gotcha.
And so beyond that, I was very politically active. I wanted people to vote. I wanted people to be represented properly in Congress with people who had integrity. And, you know, I wanted people to be treated with integrity and fairly. And, you know, really the more I finished college and I worked at the welfare department and I did different things, I saw all these abuses. And one person really, you know, even now, one person cannot change this kind of like train rushing down the tracks. You need to have a group momentum that can stop it or publicize it or, you know, speak out and vote people out. You need people to be active in their own, you know, making progress.
Strength in numbers.
Right.
I'm still not clear why it was that when you were first introduced to Jim Jones and his ideas, that you weren't attracted to them.
Well, you know, I walked in and I had like a really short skirt and long hair and makeup. I was kind of like a streetwalker. My life was cycling down, and I guess I hadn't quite hit bottom yet. But
as I recall, Laura, most young women look like that and dress like that in that period, you know.
Most of my friends did, you know. I think that that's true. But, you know, when I went into People's Temple, everybody was, they seemed so pure. You know, they seemed like, you know, bright-eyed, clear-eyed, friendly, gracious, outgoing. It was an integrated group. You know, there were wonderful children around. It was just a really such a, you know, it was almost unbelievably polished and positive. And really, I wasn't feeling all that positive those days. And so in a way, I felt like I needed to be there, but I wasn't ready to turn into that Pollyanna. You know, I'd already been through too much. I couldn't really see myself glowing, blushing young girl anymore. I was 22. I'd really been through quite a lot in, you know, 3 or 4 years. And I wasn't sure that I would fit in that spot. They were so naive, and I had kind of, I was kind of shell-shocked, I think, at that point.
You were considerably more streetwise, at least you felt you were anyway, than they were.
Right. I was, than they were, yes, but not, you know, not in the bigger scheme of things, but at least compared to them, like they were pretty protected. And so part of me, you know, I'm not sure I wanted to be protected. I wasn't sure I'd done all the wild things I wanted to do. And, you know, another thing I've kind of come to terms with is my mother raised my two sisters and myself. And so she was a single parent and very strong. And, you know, she left her husband because he was, like, philandering. And that was in the late 40s. So that was kind of an unpopular thing to do. And also it made women, you know, kind of being really careful around her with their husbands. So, but anyway, she took a position, said, okay, I'm going to do this. I know it's going to be tough, and I'll do it anyway. And so one of the main qualities that she modeled was, don't be two-faced. Don't be a hypocrite. Whatever you are, be that. But don't lie. Don't pretend you're one thing and do another or say another or think another. Whatever it is you are, just buy into it. That's you. And so when I went into People's Temple, you know, and I visited the first time, I thought to myself, okay, well, you know, this isn't me. Mm-hmm. And I already knew, you know, when I went home to San Francisco that I wasn't going to be pure and I wasn't going to be pure during the week. And I really didn't see that I could come up on Sunday and pretend I was pure and didn't plan to, you know, use, you know, smoke pot or whatever it was during the week. And then just on Sunday for that 3 hours be good and holy and devout. And then the rest of the week do what I had planned to do. So I didn't want to be a hypocrite. And I didn't want to give up what my plan was. So I didn't really fit in People's Temple right then for me.
So what changed your mind?
I guess I did hit the bottom of the barrel being in San Francisco.
What do you mean? You mean emotionally?
No. Well, you know, I got involved in all kinds of messes. I was never into drugs much, but, you know, I ended up dating a married attorney and just the things that when I sat and thought about it, they were not the way I wanted to spend my life. Mm-hmm. And so they're just a series of events. You know, I date a guy and his wife was a nurse who was, you know, addicted to drugs. Or it just seemed like everybody that I kind of glommed onto was their own special kind of deviant. And, you know, I didn't want to get dragged into it, but I didn't really know what I wanted. And so, in a way, I was at a crossroads. Okay, put up or shut up. Either you're going to join a group that's doing what you said you wanted to do, or, you know, get into the hippie culture and just, you know, use drugs and just, you know, wash out. But you had to do one or the other. And so it just became more and more apparent that the kinds of people I chose to hang out with were not the people who were going to, you know, make me feel good about the choices I made.
And yet you were at a curious place where, on the one hand, you were pretty clear in your mind as to what it is you wanted to accomplish in the world. But in terms of your view of yourself, you seemed, like many people at that age, not quite sure who you were.
Right. I mean, I think that's definitely true. And I wasn't sure what priorities I wanted to put on things. Did I want to pay the price of being political? Because when I was in college and people would use drugs or do other things, I'd say, you know, you can't be political and then play around with things that are illegal. You have to, you know, choose one or the other, because almost always if you're involved in politics, and particularly radical politics, if you're also, if you leave yourself open to be arrested or busted because of some other behavior that has nothing to do with your politics, you're kind of a sitting duck. You're putting your whole message really at risk. And so when I was in college, I could go along with that, and, you know, that worked really well. Then when my life started falling apart, I had to come up again and face, okay, so what's my choice now, 3 years down the line? And so it wasn't an immediate decision. I didn't immediately fall in love with People's Temple. I wasn't sure how I'd fit in there. So I kept coming back, you know, and then it took another 8 or 10 weeks for me to say, okay, well, this is a better decision for me. And then, of course, I met up with a man in People's Temple who was, you know, exactly what I wanted, but under Jim's roof. So, I mean, he had just gotten out of prison. He was a former heroin addict. He was very funny. He was black. He was handsome. He was really smart. And so I said, you know what? I think that with Jim Jones as kind of protecting me, as he did protect his flock, you know, what we kind of considered ourselves, with Jim protecting me, I can do this thing that I've wanted to do all along and have some protection.
There's something of a paradox in that you were interested in working in some ways against the system as it was, and yet in order to do that, you had to have all of the same attributes as somebody running for public office. You couldn't have anything that they could, stain your character with.
That's right. I mean, it's the same thing as, you know, when you go to a protest, you don't look like a slob. You try and look like the role model. I mean, in a way, it's kind of the same thing, you know.
Right. it's opposite sides of the same coin in some sense.
That's right.
when you joined the temple, did you in some way suspend your skepticism a little bit?
I think that I bought into the part of my own character that made me feel the most worthwhile. I kind of said, okay, so here's what I believe. It's time for me to follow what I believe and not get caught up in all this peripheral, superficial part that really doesn't make me happy and actually puts me at risk. So I think I didn't suspend my my curiosity, and I didn't suspend my critical thinking. Really what I did is I put Jim under a microscope for about 2 years. I really watched everything he did because, you know, my father had not been in the home and I was not, you know, a natural follower of a man anyway. And so I really felt like I checked out, you know, how his wife looked at him, how his kids thought about him. I saw, you know, at least 50 or 60 kids want to change their last name to Jones so they could be part of his family. I saw that he and his wife had been the first white couple to adopt a black child in Indiana, which is kind of the home of the Ku Klux Klan. And so I looked at everything, and I looked at how he lived, which was, you know, he had a kind of a simple house right on the church property there in Redwood Valley. Everything he did was public, because he had to drive, you know, onto the property. And, I mean, I really checked out that to see if he was a hypocrite. That was what I was most interested in. He says this, does he do it? Or he, you know, expects people to do this, does he do it too? Does he live a flamboyant lifestyle? Does he have a fancy car, diamonds dripping off him like many ministers and, you know, so-called men of God? No, he didn't. And so as I looked at him more and more over the first 2 years, I was impressed that really what he said is what he did. I mean, little did I know, but the outside appearances seemed to reflect that he was consistently, you know, good, and his interest was to do good things.
The, you know, the stereotype of a person who is drawn to, I don't know, do you agree that what Jim Jones was running was essentially a cult, whatever that is, to begin with? I guess in my definition of it would be a charismatic leader who draws people who are relatively needy, at least emotionally, and so don't necessarily question his actions, but just accept them because they are, in a sense, in essence, have a crush on him. So they don't really question his behavior. They just accept it and adopt him as a kind of father figure.
I think that that's true, but I actually generalize out more about what a cult is. And I think that a cult is something that draws people in and changes their behavior in some significant way, and in a way people follow without arguing each issue or without, it's not really without thinking, but they people join so that they don't have to, you know, make a separate decision all the time or something like that. But I think that in the United States, and that's really all I could speak to, we are a country of cults. I think that, you know, the Tea Party is a cult. I think the Marines are a cult. I think the Democratic Party is a cult. I think that we, the Girl Scouts, are a cult. Like, we have people join groups because there's strength in numbers, because we're surrounded with people who have kind of like, you know, similar interests. We are interested in accomplishing things and behaving the same and not being the wheel that squeaks the most. And so, I mean, I think that in our culture, whether it's gangs, which are also a cult, really, led by a cult leader and motivated by money or power or protection in a community, I mean, I really do think that absolutely People's Temple was a cult, and absolutely I could name 150 or 200 others if I had 5 minutes.
I understand. And so if we're going to define a cult as simply a group of people united by a philosophy and a cause, then it would seem not unreasonable to suggest that perhaps you were so motivated by the cause that you missed a lot of things that you might otherwise have seen.
That's absolutely true.
How do you feel about that now?
No question about it.
How do you feel about that now? That must be very difficult for you to come to terms with, I would think, because it took such a big chunk of your life, didn't it?
Yeah. I really despair that I didn't see it. And I have, you know, wonderful friends who left the temple long before I ever went to Guyana. And, you know, somehow they saw it and I didn't. And I don't know. I mean, the thing that, in a way, the paradox with Jim Jones is that the people, even the people who were his mistresses and secretaries in the, you know, in his small circle, they were like some of the smartest people I ever met. And so it's not really a smart thing. It's somehow Jim was like an infected apple in a barrel of apples, and he was able to infect everybody who was within that circle of his. And so
doesn't that kind of contradict your what you were saying before? If he has mistresses, that doesn't make him exactly the ideal minister, does it?
That's absolutely true. Like, I had no clue. I actually had no clue until everything was over that he was really sleeping with all these people.
I gotcha. Okay.
I mean, you know, so much of my wisdom, my so-called wisdom today, is, you know, what I've researched and found out in the last 35 years. At the time, you know, once in a while, during planning commission, which is when we'd sit and kind of a small group of us would kind of figure out where we wanted to go and what was going on, Jim would mention that somebody was feeling really depressed and he felt that he really needed to have sex with a person so that she would feel better about herself or he would feel better about himself. You know, Jim didn't care really about sexual identity. He really just used it as power. So he was completely willing to have sex with whatever other person, male or female, if he ended up the powerful one. You know what I mean? Like, so It was not a sex issue with him. He was not a sexaholic or whatever.
Right.
A sex fiend. He was not.
He's a control freak, right?
Yeah, exactly. Mm. So he would mention, you know, that he had helped somebody who was depressed or somebody who, you know, really felt they had to leave because they hadn't found anyone to love them or something like that. He would, from time to time, mention that he had had sex with somebody to make them feel better. And then, you know, and he would always make it feel like he was the savior. It was always to help someone else, right?
Yeah.
But he would bring that up, and so probably over the 7 years that I was involved with the temple, he might have said that 6 or 7 times. But, I mean, that was nowhere near what he was, the conquest he was doing. So that whole thing was a sham, the whole thing from beginning to end. But I didn't, you know, at the time I didn't know it. But since then I do know it now that, first of all, he had a longtime mistress from before I ever got in the temple. And so from 1968 or so until they both died in Guyana. So he had a long-term mistress for at least a decade that I didn't know about. And his wife, you know, was treated him lovingly because he was the father of her 5 children. And he was the one who controlled all contact. And so she could not, you know, take him on. And so, you know, there are just so many different things that he was doing behind the scenes that we had no clue about.
I imagine most people assume that you regard that whole period of your life as a mistake. If you had to live your life over again, would you absolutely and completely avoid anything that you did during the time that you were part of the People's Temple?
You know, no one really has asked me that before. I think what I would do is go in and early on start confronting the things I saw. Because the wonderful things about the temple I've never been able to replace. The total integration of all these diverse, wonderful people that so enriched my life. I've not been able to replace that. And that richness is the part, you know, that I loved. So, on the other hand, you know, the insanity that was going on behind the scenes, you know, not only should I have seen it, but now knowing, you know, now being much more cynical and much more critical in what I observe, and not just the superficial things I observe, but problem solving and asking and delving into things. I hate to throw away everything about People's Temple because there were really some wonderful things, including in Jonestown when Jim was pretty much too sick to mess around with it and screw it up. So, I mean, there were wonderful things going on in Jonestown that we had this, you know, an agricultural community that was diverse. We were learning things. We were, you know, becoming self-sufficient, still 5 or 6 years away from it. Many of us in Jonestown would never have left Jonestown. We just wanted Jim to leave us alone. If Jim had died and we had somebody else who was a benevolent leader who could, you know, kind of oversee the finances and things, we had some really wonderful things going on, and we had wonderful things going in San Francisco, a soup kitchen and free legal aid and free, you know, medical care and nurses who could take you to the doctor and, you know, I mean, letters to judges. I wrote hundreds of letters to judges telling them that, you know, people who were going to appear before them needed to have a second chance or needed to be with their children. I mean, we had some such wonderful things going that, if I had it all to do over again, from the very beginning, I'd be much more critical and not just turn over my whole, you know, not ever be such a zealot that I stopped looking. That's what happened, really. I looked really carefully for 2 years, and then after that, I just said, okay, everything is perfect. I don't need to watch every single thing, and I gave up that independence and that, you know, I just bought the whole package from that point on and stopped questioning.
It strikes me that everything that you have said about the People's Temple, many of us have said about the 1960s.
Mm-hmm. Right. I do think,
even though perhaps in some ways we blew it in the 1960s, from this vantage point in 2014, it looks as if many of the things that we put in motion in the late 1960s have come to fruition. The good things. Social change. Same could be said for you and the work that you did in the People's Temple, I think, right?
You know, it may be true, but not close enough.
Mm.
I mean, I think that we have made progress, and yet, you know, we incarcerate our people of color. We deport other people of color. We, you know, our nation is based on liberty and the pursuit of justice, but we don't always have laws that protect people from, you know, the bullies. That the bullies still run the place.
Yeah, don't they just?
So, I mean, I think that there are good things that go on in the country, and certainly having a black president is a wonderful change. Who would have imagined it, you know, even 15 or 20 years ago? So there are many changes that are wonderful, but it's just not enough.
But all of these changes, they just seem so incremental, don't they? And maybe it's difficult for any of us in our lifetime to see the changes that have occurred in our lifetime, and we have. But things do change, you know,
yeah.
And the energy that we put out is not wasted, I don't think.
And, you know, I think another point that because I'm part of the Occupy movement, and I'm part of, you know, the ACLU and Nuestro Voto and some other groups. And so I think that we have to not be satisfied with the slowness. We have to, you know, mobilize and get people to vote and all these other things, because I think that no matter what happens, nothing happens when we are lethargic. We have to be impatient. That's our job. Our job is to be impatient to get equality back as our, you know, as something that we see around us every day.
Agreed.
We should be impatient.
Agreed. Easier said than done, but people like yourself are a model for all of us.
Thanks. Can I just mention two more things?
Sure, please do.
They're just important. Not too long ago, probably within the last 3 months or something, a woman came to one of my sessions here in San Diego in the library, and she said, so knowing that people, you know, went to Guyana and died, were the people who went to People's Temple the people who had already given up? Is that why it was so easy for Jim to persuade 918 people to die? And I said, you know, it's really the total opposite. The people who joined People's Temple were visionaries. And so the fault we had was we didn't watch Jim carefully enough as he was going more and more mentally imbalanced, and his, you know, power corrupted him, and, you know, the drugs, all the different things going on with Jim. But the people who joined People's Temple were the visionaries who said, you know what? I know that if we work together, we can change the world. And that's what they were committed to do. And so, you know, the problem was we trusted Jim to be on our side and not to be, you know, mentally ill. But we were the visionaries who knew it was going to be hard work, and we took it on anyway.
But that's a good question, isn't it? Why? How is it that he was able to persuade people to do that with
right.
their children?
That's right. Well, he did, you know... I mean, that's a whole other story. One is he was doing a harangue with the adults, and then after he had, like, beaten them down and talked them into it and made them feel like they were part of the conspiracy to kill the congressman while he had their attention.
Yeah, I got that. I tell you what, Laura, may I ask you a different question?
Sure.
If you hadn't been in Georgetown, would he have been able to persuade you to drink that Kool-Aid?
If I had been in Jonestown?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, absolutely. No question about it. Because, you know, I didn't want to, even when everything happened, I didn't want to come back. I was happy in Guyana. I wasn't interested in coming back to the United States at all. I never thought I'd come back. So, you know, it wouldn't have been a tough sell to tell me, you know, they're going to come in, they're going to bust you, they're going to take you back to the United States. You don't have any money. You don't have any job. Nobody wants to have anything to do with you. You've killed a congressman. You know, you're going to be forever on the run. And so, I mean, in a way, Jim, you know, had all these reasons to tell people why it was essential. And so at that point, you know, that's when it became brainwashing, when he said, you don't have a choice. And my response today is, you know, I came back owing the government money and having nothing to go on, and yet I ended up being a teacher in San Diego. So you can survive anything at all with help. You can survive anything. But Jim never gave people that out. He never said that. He said, you won't be able to survive this at all, and your children will be taken and put in foster care and, you know, everything else, and you'll be back in this racist system. And so, you know, Jim just kept up the harangue, arguing down everything that people might have thought or said. And so people were exhausted. They trusted Jim. They'd already, you know, followed him for thousands of miles to move into the rainforest in Guyana. So they, you know, didn't have the, you know, the wherewithal really to argue back when he was so vigilant.
Mm.
And I would have been there too.
It's so difficult to understand. It's a little Kafkaesque, you know. It's so difficult to understand that we can find ourselves in a culture where the irrational seems rational.
That's right.
And yet it's so easy for that to happen to any of us, isn't it?
That's right. It was way too easy because the people who died were, you know, wonderful, gifted, smart people, and we just got sucked up in this, you know, this, I don't know, tsunami.
Mm-hmm. But for the grace of God, somebody, you had a guardian angel looking out for you, didn't you?
You know, at first I always, even when I wrote my book, I thought, you know, it was just a fluke that I was in Georgetown. But actually, I've come to terms with it that, you know, nothing was ever accidental in the temple. And so when Jim was looking around and he knew that Congressman Ryan was going to come down and he knew, you know, that things were going to get really tough, he said, okay, what suckers can I send into Georgetown who are going to speak nicely about Jonestown? Oh, there's Laura. So, you know, it really wasn't so accidental that I'd be in Georgetown. Because, you know, I did love Jonestown. I absolutely loved it, and I lived there almost 2 years in both Georgetown and Jonestown, and I did love it. And so it wasn't really so surprising that he would pick somebody who was still a zealot through everything to go into Georgetown. So it wasn't really that accidental.
Well, I grant you, Laura, that's a rational explanation, but I'm not sure that it's certainly not the only one. Things happen for a reason. And maybe, you know, it was because that just wasn't, you know, that wasn't your dharma. You know, your dharma was to come back and survive and to help others who have been in similar situations to come to terms with what they went through and help them through it.
You know, if I didn't know the 918 people who died, I might buy that. But there were just too many wonderful people. It made no sense that I would survive and somebody else would die, people that I know. So, you know, I mean, like, I'm too close to it to see anything like a harmony in nature, or I'm too close to it to make a judgment on why me, why not somebody else that I knew and loved.
Mm. Oh, I can certainly understand that. I mean, that's impossible. You can't, there's no way you could make that decision.
Right. Like, who could make that choice?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, exactly. That's Sophie's choice, isn't it?
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. It's easy for me to do it because I'm outside it.
Mm-hmm.
It's fun talking to you.
Really nice talking to you.
Thanks, Laura.
All right.
That was WUTC's Richard Winham speaking with Laura Johnston Cole, a survivor of the Jonestown Massacre. Cole will be here in Chattanooga on April 15th and 16th. On the 15th at 7 p.m., she'll be at the Chattanooga Society of Friends meeting, and she'll present a spiritual journey talk about her life, including how she became a Quaker 20 years ago. On the 16th at 6 p.m., she'll be at the Chattanooga Public Library having a book talk about her book Jonestown Survivor, An Insider's Look. You can find more information about her online at JonestownSurvivor.com. That's it for Rounded About Chattanooga. Thank you all for listening.
Around and About Chattanooga is a production of WUTC with contributions by the staff and volunteers of WUTC. Find us online at wutc.org.